You're now listening to the Liminalist, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley on his own. Friday the 13th, 2020, and I don't have a podcast for tomorrow. Now, I'm quite anal about these things. I don't know if that's fair to myself. I'm diligent, conscientious, committed, but also a little bit anal about having a weekly podcast and having it out on time every week. Even try to make a blog post once a week now on a Wednesday if I can. Who knows exactly what motivates that, but I do imagine there are at least a few of you out there who have somewhat come to depend on your horticultural fix. Not that I want to feed anyone's addiction or dependency, but at the same time, I appreciate your appreciation, and if you get a lot out of these weekly deliveries, then I do want to keep them up if and when I can, and that's mostly all of the time. Currently, my mind is on something that probably a lot of your minds is on too. It's this coronavirus business, and that's because it's affecting my business. Running a thrift store in a small town, we are potentially a primary a hub for the spreading of said virus, and some businesses are indeed closing down. And I heard that large gatherings are being viral invasions. 237. Everything is up in the air at this time. But then it always has been. So this would seem to be something to do with the collective consciousness of humanity becoming cognizant of that reality of liminality, that everything is indeed up in the air at this time and always has been, possibly always will be, at least until we surrender body, heart, and soul to life itself and move into an effortless ease of existence, eternal, unchanging existence. In the meantime, it would seem we are on the threshold of something significantly less benign or sublime, a smartification of humanity, of the human body and of human society and of nature and of everything that walks, crawls, swims, flies or slithers on this earth. Well, I don't know if they're going to smartify the worms. Well, the birds will certainly try. An IP address for every grain of sand, I hear, they have in store for us. Why not, after all? Why not try and map infinity, turn it into a prison? A prison for God. Can you build a prison big enough for God? Which is rather like the old saying about, can God build an object that is so heavy that he can't lift it? Seems to me that this iteration of existence that we're in now, insofar as it indicates an ongoing experiment of God to incarnate through humanity and not destroy itself in the process, is a similar kind of enterprise, as in something that is as close to impossible for God to accomplish as is possible, as close to impossible as possible. God has created the heaviest object that he could possibly create to see if he can lift it. The human heart, like a stone, sinking all the way into matter, and then attempting to grow a tiny fragile pair of wings, and upon those wings to ascend once again out of the deep dark chasms of forgetting into a remembrance of what we ultimately are. Do not ask why. Do not even pause upon that question of why, because the ways of God are not to be fathomed by mortal men. Whether mortal men can become as gods and then live the answer to why, live the question why and embody the answer, remains to be seen. I am optimistic against all the odds. I have no reason to be optimistic based on any kind of observation of the world at large or any kind of logical deduction. I can't make an argument for optimism, and I won't try. I can just tell you that my body is optimistic. And even despite the aches and pains and creakings and groanings of aging and infirmity, and even the increasing sniffles of allergies and whatnot, all the signs being less than great, still this innate felt sense of goodness, of benevolence, of positivity, of opportunity, of joy, of burgeoning joy, remains, and in fact seems to be growing in tandem with the intensification of the darkness of these times, just as we would expect the stars to be much more visible on an especially dark night sky. Which reminds me, last night I saw a very unusual star, a thing in the light in the sky, a light in the sky, which seemed it could only be a star because it absolutely wasn't moving at all, completely stationary, and yet was so bright and large and was not surrounded by any other stars. There was one other star in the whole sky. There were some clouds. It was mostly a sort of foggily clear night. I mean, it wasn't a clear night because I couldn't see the other stars, but there weren't visible clouds either, or many. So, anyway, I don't know what that light was. And I gazed at it for a time while I was walking home, and then I meant to go out and check it again later and then mention it to my wife when she came home, but I forgot. Just slipped my mind until I was in bed. And then it felt too late. I also felt, well, perhaps these are things that shouldn't be pursued too much mentally. I saw it, it was there. Knowing what it was probably wouldn't be any better than not knowing. It was something. Maybe it was a star that was particularly bright, or a planet that was unusually close. Maybe it was an alien spaceship. Maybe it was a soul hovering over. There's all kinds of possibilities, including a smart satellite watching my every move, including not very pleasant possibilities. But it doesn't really matter anyway, that was a digression. So what I'm trying to do now, not knowing whether I'm succeeding or whether I'll succeed enough to share this, which makes a kind of conundrum, because the only way to really do this, do justice to this, to bring life to it, for there to be life in it, is if I'm responding to listeners out there hearing this now. Except the now in question isn't my now, but it's your now. If this ever does make it out there, you're hearing this now, which could be tomorrow if I get a podcast up on Saturday. It could be 100,000 years from now. You never know. Definitely not optimistic, nor am I particularly concerned about anything I do or anything human beings do at a material level surviving more than 10 years, but never mind 100,000. But you can't rule it out either, nor can we rule out the possibility that it might be useful in some way, that I might be, some of us might be leaving breadcrumbs or beads. What was it, Ariadne left a thread in the labyrinth for others to follow and find their way out of after we have long gone. I may be attempting to leave some kind of legacy that will be helpful to others. I mean, I know I am. I just don't know if any of these physical things have anything to do with it. But my point here was is that I don't know that this is going to ever air, so I don't know if there will ever be an audience or a listener, you, the potential future you. So then, who am I responding to? Who am I speaking to now? Am I able to tune into the souls that might hear this? And if I'm not, is that because I will never air this and no one will ever hear it? Or will it be a self-fulfilling thing that because I'm unable to take that leap and tune into possible in the dimension in which some souls will hear this, then I can't actually find my voice, I can't find the guiding intelligence and follow it, and so it won't be worth airing. So indeed, no one will ever hear it, so no wonder I couldn't express anything of any meaning, because there was no one to hear it. Back to the tree in a forest, isn't it? In a strange way. And yet, I think that this is probably illusory as a question or a conundrum or a kind of time travel paradox. Because, in fact, what I'm doing now is affecting others, whether or not they ever hear it. And regardless of whether I am able to respond to the guiding intelligence and transmit a true signal of my soul, my body and my soul, or not, it's still going to have an effect. So that's the question, isn't it, really? Like, if we're going to eat stuff, then we have a responsibility either way. We eat junk food and we affect our nervous system and therefore our energy level and therefore our animus and our emotional state and our thoughts that are generated and thereby our actions. All of that gets influenced by the choice or the automatic habit to eat junk food, which I'm off currently, so I guess that's a topical topic. I've been having cravings recently as well. Chips and cheese, not so much chocolate. And so, by the same token, of course, if we eat something else, we eat healthily, then likewise, there isn't an option to stay on the fence there. You eat, you must eat, and therefore what you eat and what you choose to eat has repercussions in eternity, or at least in a very, very large space and time continuum. I think we can say in eternity, essentially, because if anything gets incorporated into eternity, then I suppose everything does, although I think it gets crunched down in some remarkable way so that there's nothing but the essence left. And yet, that essence is the elixir of our life experience, and so even the smallest decision is going to affect the quality of the elixir. Otherwise, it would just all be the same result, wouldn't it? Every life no matter how it was lived, would end up with the same boiled down essence. And then there'd be no point. Although, when we get to points, we're getting to the question why, so I guess I shouldn't assume there is a point in any of this. But the point that I was attempting to make a moment ago was is that all of our actions have consequences. They ripple through eternity. And so me doing this podcast is already affecting you, if there is a you, and everyone else, whether or not anyone hears this or not, because it's affecting how I am in my body and in my life. So far I'm enjoying it, even though all I'm doing is looking at a computer screen with a sound wave thing. I suppose I'm feeling you out there, whoever you are. Certain souls are coming to mind, because I know more or less that you would be listening if this was a podcast. I feel like a radio host now. DJ, play Misty for me. Guy came into the shop today, his name is Al, and he was coming in to be in from the cold, because it was very cold and it was cold wind, and he was the first person to come in, and I knew he doesn't buy anything, he doesn't have money, he often just takes things, asks for them and takes them, and or he just hangs out to keep warm, and he has good days and bad days, and he can be very annoying, and he can just be mildly annoying, and he can be more or less innocuous. But I was aware of just wanting to give him the space to get warm, and he wasn't bothering me. There was no reason for me to bother him. Anyway, he came back again a second time, and he wanted some gloves, and I said he could look over there, and then he grabbed this pair I'd put out recently, which was a very nice, kind of looked handmade, women's gloves, really, and they were stitched together visibly, so they looked quite rustic, and I thought those were quite special gloves, so I didn't really like that he was grabbing them, and I just thought that they would be way too small for him, so I said, well, they're too small for you, you know, and he said, no, I can make them fit, and he started picking at them, and I thought he was going to undo the thread, which seemed really crazy, but I just thought he was saying, I know how I can make these bigger, and he was going to do some crazy street person thing on them. And so I went over and said, no, don't do that, and I was going to take them back, but then I realised he was just taking a safety pin out. And but fortunately he didn't get offended or anything. It wasn't a awkward moment, except at my end. And I noticed that he'd to put on the gloves or get the gloves ready, and they did fit him, he had put down a cheroot, and I said, oh, that's like Clint Eastwood smokes in A Fistful of Dollars, and he said, exactly that, that's right, exactly that. So I knew at once he was a Clint Eastwood fan, or he'd enjoyed those movies in his time. It's a guy in his 60s or something like that. And then he said something about Charles Bronson. And I said, no, not Charles Bronson. He's a second-rate version of Clint Eastwood. And then he said, what about Lee Marvin? And I said, yeah, Lee Marvin was the real deal. And he said, oh, yeah, I like Lee Marvin, Paint Your Wagon. I said, well, Clint Eastwood was in that. And I said, and Lee Marvin sang in that, and it was a hit. What are the odds of that? Anyway, he was very engaged at this point, because he was obviously really into Lee Marvin. So we were bonding over Lee Marvin, and then I said, well, it was Wandering Star that he sang, and he said, yeah. And then I sang a few bars. It's just, if you haven't heard it, then you really need to hear Lee Marvin singing Wandering Star. I was born under a wandering star. Well, it wasn't a very good imitation, but if you turn the bass way up on that, you'd have Lee Marvin singing Wandering Star. Singing is a generous use of the term, growling it. And it was a number one hit. And you can see why if you listen to it. It really has something going for it. So anyway, Al left, and he was quite happy. He'd got his gloves, and he'd had a meaningful moment with a fellow Clint Eastwood and Lee Marvin fan, all sparked by that cheroot, which normally I'm quite repelled if people bring cigarettes unlit. Obviously, they would be unlit into the shop, or any kind of hint of tobacco I find repellent. But because the cheroot had special meaning for me, it led to a positive exchange rather than a negative one.
Steamboat sailing by the cedar rose up the string, wild rose drinking the tea. Dietrich playing cards on horseback in a bullfight, waving at me with her feet. Oh, where can you be, my lover man? Playground, a million bits are on the loose in Waterloo, up and down in the rain. Come on, everybody's in the mood, and where are you? I'll keep watching on. Oh, where can you be, my lover man?
I also had a more difficult exchange with another street person who's called Steve, and he, Flint Napper Steve, he's always building himself a shelter. I mean, pretty much, it seems just, if he hasn't just failed to build one, or had it knocked down or blown away by the latest gale or what have you, then he's starting another one, it seems to me. It's at regular intervals anyway. He's talking about building himself a shelter, summer, winter, whatever. So he's doing that now, a shack, he called it this time. Anyway, he came in, and I had heard from my wife that Steve, Flint Napper Steve, might have caught the coronavirus because he'd been ill for a couple of weeks and he'd had a lot of the symptoms. And so she had written something down saying Flint Napper Steve might have the coronavirus. And I don't take the coronavirus that seriously as an actual epidemic yet. I haven't seen any evidence to do so. I have been feeling a few symptoms, and I'm not saying I ignore them, obviously. Like, it does make things more weighted and freighted knowing that this is supposedly going around. But my wife takes it more seriously. She's following research more, and there's no doubt that it's having serious consequences, as everyone listening to this will know. School trips are being cancelled, flights are being cancelled, people are being quarantined, prevented from leaving, imprisoned in their homes, toilet paper's selling out, businesses are closing down, factories, Amazon even, I think, closed some of its factories, and so on. So far, there's this domino effect that it just keeps rolling. Oh, it's 2:37. This may, as I said at the start, this may really impact our business, which will impact everything else in our lives, as in me and my wife and cat's lives, and also other people close to us, including people maybe even listening to this. Certainly my Oshana project might get, so anyway, you get the drill. It's serious in its repercussions, whether or not there's a serious danger to humanity here or some socially engineered device for implementing, introducing the agendas that are already pre-prepared, as in a cooking show. As I happen to have a ready-made version of this that you're just hearing the ingredient, the recipe for, or just watching me prepare it, well, here's the finished version of human society, or planet Earth, post-coronavirus pandemic. It seems as though a lot of it was already in place, including getting rid of money, moneyless system, and so on. At least to some of us more paranoid. And we actually have a money-only system in our thrift store. We don't take anything but money. Anyway, this guy, Corona Steve, as I'm now thinking of him, Flint Napper Steve, he came in, and generally when he comes in, he's pretty incoherent, smokes a lot of pot. His health generally isn't that good, and he never buys anything, and he just stands around often in the doorway. And so he is much more irritating than Al, even though he's less aggressive, although I did almost get into a fight with him one time. Add to that, he might be carrying the CV. I was extra cautious about letting him hang around, so I really said right away, well, Steve, what's this I heard about you maybe having the virus, and you really probably shouldn't be hanging out here if there's any chance of that. I was becoming much more proactive than I've ever been before about this, because of the influence of my wife, and I suppose because Steve is already a bit problematic as a customer, and so it kind of magnified that, which on the larger subject, I did hear this morning also from my wife that, should I call her my wife? What do you say out there, women? Is that demeaning somehow? The reason I call her my wife is that I don't want to use her name, because I feel that names are identification tags, like microchips. People hear my wife's name, they'll be able to get a bead on her more easily than if they hear my wife. And my wife emphasizes that this is something that's under my protection, something that I realize that made my wife seem even more like an object, but I mean the subject. I'm talking about someone that I consider to be under my protection. So that's what I mean for you ladies and feminists out there when I always use the term my wife. Anyway, she said this morning that she had heard, third hand this is, now, that in Chilliwack, the town, the large town nearest us, or the largest town near to us, businesses were closing down and so on and so forth, and people who were seen sniffing or coughing were receiving quite hostile reactions from the people around them, and so you imagine how that this could snowball really, as the panic increases and the reactions become ever more reactive, the scapegoat mechanism, because this is all about liminality. In my view, this is why the coronavirus, and if they do have an agenda, if there is an agenda for certain factions and different governments to implement, and the coronavirus is the trigger or the lever for unveiling that agenda, or one of them, then I would say what's different with the coronavirus from SARS or Ebola or bird flu or mad cow disease or any other number of possible epidemics from the past few decades that haven't caused this domino effect that we're seeing this time, it has to do with liminal times, that we're at a time in history, 2020, at which people are really feeling the pressure of uncertainty, of instability, of not knowing what's up and what's down, which walls they can lean on or chairs they can sit on that won't collapse, what structures are solid, you know, ideologically, philosophically, or ontologically, or ideologically, or physically and literally in terms of institutions and governments and agencies and whatnot, and the economy. And health, of course, is a big part of that, the medical establishment and our individual health. And that's being tweaked now, obviously, big time, like a big pussy boil being pushed with a surgical finger to explode. And, one of the ways we would see this is mimetic behavior, mimetic, well, I was going to say rivalry, but that's, I guess, toilet paper. You got people are competing over toilet paper, so that does constitute rivalry, leading to mimetic violence, people fighting over toilet paper, and the scapegoat mechanism as the way to neutralize that. People, if there's a tension building in communities, so people are starting to see each other as potential threats or rivals and tempted to attack or kill or dismember one another over who gets this roll of toilet paper, the way to neutralize that is to narrow the focus to individual scapegoats, and then you have the sniffles, the coughs. Those are the enemy. Kill them, isolate them, condemn them, quarantine them, destroy them, purge the system of their pollutants. Anyway, I did act a little bit like that today with Flint Napper Steve, but I think, knowing as I do that he's quite reactive and defensive and he didn't react or defend, I can't have been too heavy-handed. I just said, if you're not going to shop here, Steve, you should probably leave. He said, no, I am going to shop here. Well, first of all, I challenged him, said, you know, how do you know you're not carrying it and you're passing it around? And it's problematic because he doesn't necessarily have anywhere to go except his shack, but still, I felt I had to address it. And he said, no one I've been near has got sick. And I said, well, how do you know that? It has a 2-week incubation period. And he said, no, I don't want. So it wasn't going in. So I realized there wasn't much point in reasoning with him in a general way. So then it was just about my specific boundaries. And as it happened, the ex-mayor was in the shop shopping at that time, which kind of increased the tension. Because whatever impression I was creating on Steve, whether I was being effective or not, the ex-mayor was a witness to that, as well as other shoppers. And, you know, it could go tits up quite quickly. It could backfire quite quickly if I was too heavy-handed or not firm enough and so on, plus Steve's reaction. So it was all quite delicate. And when Steve started looking through the clothes, because I'd just discussed with my wife, well, how do we reduce the risks here so that we can stay open as long as possible and be responsible? We can't not touch the money. Obviously, we can not touch people, encourage people not to touch each other. I mean, this is the thing. Are people still shaking hands? And if so, why? We considered having a sign up saying do not touch the goods, but then we realized, well, there's clothing on racks, there's no way to look at the clothes without touching them, so we can't do that. But anyway, this has kind of driven home this thing of, gosh, every time someone comes in and touches something, there's a risk that they're spreading this virus. So when Steve started fingering the $5 items, I said, no, come on, Steve, you're not shopping here, are you? And he said, no, I am shopping. I want to get a coat. So I took him at his word, and I backed off at that point. And he did buy a coat. He bought a thick jacket for $5, and he took off, I guess, two of his jackets, and he still had a jacket on, and then he put the jacket he'd bought on top of the jacket he was wearing. And these are heavy jackets, all of them. I don't mean just thick shirts or whatever, like real jackets. And then he put the third one on, and I said, wow, four jackets, huh? And then he took a long time putting the fourth one on. He took about 10 or 15 minutes more to leave, but I just held the space for him. I didn't want to provoke him unnecessarily, and it wasn't like the shop was full of customers anyway. But anyway, it gave me an opportunity to sort of gauge this sensitive zone between irresponsibility or negligence and panic, overreactivity. Like, where's the sweet spot? Where's the middle way here, where we're taking responsibility for the possibility that this may be a very real pandemic, even if it's been created and it's being, you know, 12 monkeys style. It's a manufactured vial of the apocalypse. That doesn't really make much difference in terms of how we take the necessary measures to contain it in our own communities, because that's the basic reality. Besides that of the social clampdown or the social changes that it's causing, is that the weak and the vulnerable may be dying from this virus. They may be. I think 7% is the figure that I heard from Martin Jolly, was because it was 500 out of 900 people, I think. 9,000 people. Not 500 out of 900. Anyway, whatever the figure is, and whether it's, if it's real. So, that was a long spiel. I've been talking for 34 minutes. And now I'm thinking. The preceding point, I don't really like the word point, is that it's very pointed. And it suggests I'm doing a TED talk or I'm in class, Jordan Peterson style, building some sort of argument. I'm not really. I'm just sharing. But still, I'm groping my way towards something that not even I know the shape of, or around something, perhaps. So, anyway, what I was addressing previously was the general, the coronavirus and its effects on the community, and the specifics, but the general is the dark intensifying the light, and this feeling of increased well-being and optimism about existence, about being here in existence as a human experience of human, a part of humanity. Even though I've always known that humanity was hopelessly and hideously contaminated, possibly beyond the point of any kind of salvation without intervention from other dimensions, let's say. I've always felt that, and in the years since always feeling it, you know, in my life, I've observed more and more evidence of it. But I suppose one thing that's changed in the last 12 years since I've known Dave, that's come much more into concrete, tangible experience, is seeing the evidence for something else, for the goodness of humanity, which is something I've also known or felt, had a felt sense of, but I wouldn't say the evidence has really accumulated over the years. I mean, in a certain sense it has, because my life has been full of very positive experiences with other humans, the life force, you know, other carriers of the life force. But on the other hand, as you know, some of you, it's been quite misguided and distorted and hubristic and overly driven and quite dark, really, and self-destructive until about the age of 40. I mean, I do mark that time where I just, as I've said, the Icarus crashed, so I couldn't get any close to the sun. I plummeted, and that was too harmful. I mean, I got hurt plummeting as well, but once I'd hit ground, that was it. There wasn't much more I could do to fuck myself up after that. I was just licking my wounds and putting myself, Humpty was putting himself back together, and like, ooh, well, thank God that all of heaven's horses come to my aid. Although it wasn't anything dramatic like that, of course, but with hindsight, there were inner resources, horses of resources that I didn't really know I had, and I still don't know the extent of it. The Paraclete, the Comforter, the Consoler. The body itself, the cells of the body that regenerate, the transmission that echoes through the cells and brings them to life like stars in the sky as a neural network. The whole body is made of neurons, conscious cells of being. And there's really no limit to the restorative, redemptive power of that transmission if we open our fascia to it ourselves. And we have to overthrow the totalitarian system, but not through violence or revolution. Paradoxically, it's via a kind of surrendering to it, giving it nothing to push against.
There's a choir. Track me and make me forget I've left.
So where are we now then, humanity? A small pocket of humanity that listens to the Liminalist, reads my blog, and the assumption might be that by doing the things I do I've created that audience, but it might be more accurate to wonder if you haven't created the output. In fact, the output itself is the shape of your collective being. I mean, obviously it's not a perfect facsimile of it, for very far from it. But it's a rough sketch. You imagine a kid's doodle of his parents and the house and the dog, and you know more or less what it's supposed to be. You're not going to tell the kid it's a crappy drawing because daddy's legs aren't that long or anything like that. You're just gonna, you know what it is. It's you. This picture that we're painting together, just one sketch of it, but that's what draws you to listen here. To see a picture of yourself emerging through another soul who's also you. Your ultimate only self, the spirit that is undivided, individual. The human individual, incarnate, the incarnation. The resurrection, I guess, because we only really discover that what we are through surrender, and we only ever surrender through getting pinned in an impossible position where there's no way out. And that is where we're at. We're at the crossroads of the crucifixion, the collective crucifixion. Humanity gives up the ghost to God. It is finished, tetelestai. That's our one chance, anyway. If we can emulate that in these times and see the Roman centurion of the supercultural world state, global government, AI, Antichrist Incorporated system of smartification as the agent of God's will, that is completing our mission, or allowing us to complete our mission by creating the circumstances in which we can perform the ultimate letting go, the miracle of surrender. Something like that, anyway. And as I didn't finish saying, it really isn't all bad. It depends where our attention is. If our attention is on the majority, and our assumption is that majority rules, then we're doomed. Just as if we were to stare at the night sky and deduce that there's so much more darkness than there is light, that there's no possible conceivable way that the light won't be swallowed up by the darkness. Rather than observing what we observe, which is that there is no darkness so dark that light doesn't penetrate it. So the victory of light is in the nature of light. It's not really a victory, because the competition or the rivalry between light and darkness is an illusion of the mind. There's no war in heaven. There's a war in the human psyche. And because the human psyche is the lens by which God views its creation, it appears to us at this time with this fractured lens that the war is in God himself. Even that God is dead. Mortally wounded. But these are appearances, though, within the finite. And I still can't finish what I'm saying here, because it's difficult to say, but that I've seen human beings come together and be together in a way that is truly harmonious, truly loving, truly courageous, truly fruitful, truly honest, truly inspiring and transformative, and adequately represents nature, a higher aspect of nature. The beauty of the bees, I find the bees particularly beautiful. Mark was saying even houseflies are beautiful if we were deconditioned about that. Cockroaches, you name it. There is beauty in everything, including human beings. Human beings, however, have this unique capacity to not be themselves. And so then that particular beauty is a very bizarre kind of inversion of beauty. So what human beings might be if they were truly themselves, they would be as beautiful as bees or as birds or as mountains or as trees or as the sun itself, and fully human, not despite being human but because of being human. And that's the image of the divine that's unique, I think. In some way unique. But anyway, whatever it is, it's possible to see it in everyone and everything. But it certainly helps to see it consistently over a period of time with a limited number of people and in a way that's predominant. Not just a glimpse here and a glimpse there, but is by and large the general orientation and quality of the interaction and behaviour and the appearance and the being of the beings in question. I'm talking about that island in Finland, really. But I don't want to be selling it. I'm talking about Dave too, the sweetness and the clarity and the honesty and the simplicity and the raw passion that I experience in Dave, but in others too around Dave, and now in others totally unrelated. Like, once you see it, you start to feel it and follow it and be it, then it proliferates, becomes more and more in evidence, in existence. So this was all to say that my felt sense of optimism or of a positive outcome to this shitstorm that we're in isn't only an inner felt sense. There is a body of evidence that's growing to support it. Now, it's a difficult one to testify to, as I've just demonstrated, but it's not impossible. There's a way to be optimistic and to present an alternate perspective to unremitting darkness that isn't Pollyannish, that isn't naive New Ageism, that isn't spiritual or religious platitudes. There is a way, and that is the way through and out this labyrinth that we're in. So if anything motivates us to do anything at all, then let it be that. Whether we're eating, whether we're sleeping, whether we're shitting, whether we're pissing or fucking or farting or watching Netflix or shopping or walking in nature or hanging out with our pets or discussing or arguing or writing or reading. Whatever it is that we're doing, what motivates us, what is motivating us, can it be that? Can it be that this is increasing my orientation, our orientation to the way out, to the way through, to the solution that isn't a formula? So solution is a tricky word. Implies problem, reaction, solution, or even problem, response, solution. It's not how God moves mysteriously. However, it is the solution. It's just that it's not that it comes as a response to a problem. It's that when we embrace the problem, as in when we fully face it without flinching, it starts with the other, the human other, to be able to stand in front of the human other and look them in the eye and not to flinch in a single cell or molecule or atom of our bodies, to be completely at peace, at ease, without agitation and open to that other. Then we see, well, then there is no problem. In fact, the problem of our otherness, or the otherness of the other, whatever it is that we feel is infringing upon our survival or our peace of mind, is not. And so it presents the solution, which is be open and receive what is in this present moment, and this present moment will land in consciousness, in you, in us, and move us. We will then be moved. We are moved as that is landing. It's not a linear thing. It's difficult to speak about because we're landing in eternity. And then we leave, like we were never here, which we realize we never were here. There was an image of us in time. We are elsewhere, and we are other. And it's a very exciting time to be alive, if we can be in that. Then life, the story, life on Earth, 2020, becomes the greatest story never told. In one sense, told over and over again, it's so damn good. But, well, I don't know really. We're waiting for the miracle. That's all. What a time to be alive. I don't know if I have any more to add to this. I may have shot my load. Is there an echo? Are you that echo? Do you hear this? Does it resonate within you in such a way that there's a response? This is Radio Nowhere, Radio Abandon, Radio Hope. This is the signal that transmits from heaven all the way to hell. You can ride the signal, you can ride the wave, but only if you're light enough to mount it. You have to be as light as a radio wave, as light as an electron. But since you are made of electrons, then all you have to do is let go of everything that you've added to that essential configuration of electrons, all the crust and the crud, and return to your original state as a collective, a hive of electrons buzzing energetically and enthusiastically in infinity, and you will be as light as a single electron, because they don't add up. They don't add up, they merge. 1 plus 1 electron equals 1. Maybe it's a binary system. Every electron you unite with is a zero. And it's multiplication. 1 times 0 isn't 1, it's 0. The journey of zero distance can only be taken by zeros. But what a journey. It's very Freudian, isn't it? The stick and the hole, the one and the zero, come together right now over me. Well, I hope this has been a podcast. I'll edit it, I'll listen to it with my partner, and put some music in, of course. And if it meets the approval of the one and the zero, then you get to hear it. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Strangers in the dark change with the times. And all the little sins, all the letdowns and wins, the things you begin with, the things that you end with, the changes in the heart change with the times. Changes in the heart change with
words.